Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlossophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlossophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is my co-host, good friend, and also the one and original Mr. Spencer Williams.
Yes, hello, I am original.
He is original, and speaking of copycats, we have with us intern slash red shirt slash slowly going down the totem pole, Amy.
You're off for 1 week.
I'm off for 1 week. I literally just watched The Prestige. I don't know if I'm the man in the box or if I'm the man at The Prestige at this point.
Well, you keep comparing yourself to the main starlet of this film, and so that's going to be an interesting conversation as we dive into this week's episode of the Academy Award-winning film, because the Oscars just passed, Academy Award-winning film, The Substance. So stick around as we dive into that film, get our thoughts and our takes on it, and get into Amy's whole comparison as to why she feels like Demi Moore. But before we get into any of that, Spencer, why don't you give us those official opening credits?
Tune into brand new episodes each and every week.
Week!
On
week?
All of your favorite streaming platforms.
Week.
And over our website at filmlossophers.com. Also, connect with us on the socials at facebook.com/filmlossophers and on Twitter and Instagram and Threads at filmlossophy101. We also have a blue sky at Filmlossophers Podcast.
That's right. Yeah. We got a website. If you head on over to filmlossopherspodcast.com, there we got allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thrills, and chills. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlossopherspodcast.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, Amazon Music. You can tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmlossophers. Give us a follow and a subscribe. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
Yes, please.
This last episode we did was on 2025's The Monkey. And mind you, it was a great episode with our newly minted intern, Sarah, on for that episode, giving us her area of expertise. And it was a very interesting episode. So you should check that out. Lesson 419. So... yeah. We'll get you the rest of the social links at the end of the episode. I wanted to kind of change things up a bit for you guys. And I was thinking about it. And I don't know if you guys realize this, but there is a constant outpouring of theories and thoughts and whatnot when it comes to movies and kind of what we perceive as our reality and what other people perceive as their reality for movies. So I wanted to kind of switch things up, as I mentioned, and I wanted to move one of our segments that we typically do towards the tail end and actually move it up to this part because I wanted your guys' opinion, okay? So we are going to do conspiracy theory.
Okay.
Now,
about what?
Now, here's the thing. That's the thing. I found a couple of outrageous film theories, and I'm going to read them out. I'm going to read one out to you. I'm not going to do all of them right now because I want your guys' thoughts. And possibly even try to give me your, what is your take on it? Okay?
I'm going to try. I make no promises at this point. I've been demoted to red shirt.
Really?
Red shirts do what they can.
She demotes herself and gives us the same amount of work. Okay, good to know.
I did the notes.
you did the notes? This is her second time doing the notes. Hey. So... this is the theory that surrounds the movie that we all know and love, because obviously trying to find a movie that Amy's seen is, sometimes difficult. Mm-hmm.
he says that while I take a drink of water.
True. Mm-hmm. The theory is about the early 90s classic Disney film, Aladdin.
Okay.
Oh. Now, this is not the one that you guys have heard countless times. We're not talking about, it takes place in the future, blah, 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 blah. No.
Okay.
This is a different one.
Okay.
Is it the other main one?
I don't know.
Where it fits into the rest of the other movies?
No. Okay. I don't know.
That I was like, is it?
Those are the two.
So, So the theory is, and mind you, this theory only encompasses the first film. Okay. So the events of the second or third one don't really apply to this.
I'm not going to talk about his dad.
Yeah.
So the theory about this first film is that at the end of the movie, mm-hmm. Aladdin still has two more wishes. Now, let me explain.
Let me explain. I'm tracking.
So the moment in question is when Aladdin and the genie, as well as Abu and the carpet, make their way out of the cave, and Aladdin then begins to kind of barter as to like what kind of or kind of wager what kind of wishes he can make. He then tells Genie, make me a prince. He doesn't say, you know, turn me into or have me become. He says, make me a prince. And so essentially he doesn't wish to just become one. He says, make him. So ultimately, if you take the events of the whole movie, Aladdin technically becomes a prince at the end of the movie.
Potentially, yes.
Which then, through the magical ties of whatever contracts and legalities that you have when you make a wish with the genie, everybody knows, then thus fulfills that first wish.
Okay.
Because, well, he doesn't even technically marry Jasmine in the first movie. So technically, he's not a prince by marrying a princess.
But that's only informed by the other movies, yeah. Since we're ignoring them.
Exactly.
It's not technically informed.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, and see, my thought on this is going to sound dumb because...
Sounds dumb.
Thanks.
Wow. Let her get it out.
Oh, I'm just going to sit back and if I wasn't excited.
Let her talk.
This is a PG-13 show. We're not letting anybody let it out. Go ahead.
Okay, so we know that in the third act, Jafar gets the lamp, therefore becoming the new owner of the lamp. Every new owner of the lamp gets three wishes. When Aladdin reclaims the lamp, taking it from Jafar, wouldn't that have reset his wishes?
No.
Really?
I don't think so.
We're getting into the whole wish movie of what is a wish again.
Exactly. So if we look at what the general terms of what movies had been at that point up until then when it comes to wishes and whatnot, it's typically the wish being fulfilled, move on to the next wish. That's usually how it goes. Any instance, whether if it's with leprechauns, with genies, with any kind of wish granting type of entity, it is make the wish is fulfilled. What is your second wish? That's how the storybooks even go. If you look at genies and you look at jinns and you look at any entities that offer any kind of reward, especially with leprechauns. Leprechauns are notorious for that. If you look that in lore as well as folklore, as well as, you know,
but that's
storytelling.
A leprechaun versus a genie.
But what I'm saying is that those are the same kind of scruples, if you will. Those are the same kind of structure that they use for this. Yeah, so, you know, ultimately, the genie doesn't make him become a prince at that moment. His wish is for him to make him. So ultimately set him on a journey to become a prince.
This is such a legalistic topic.
So
because you're really getting into what does make mean in the sentence? And like you're going before a judge trying to say why this is like not a valid wishing strategy. When I would also argue, we actually don't know how this specific genie's wishes work. Like, what if it's like, you know, monkey paw where, like, you get what you want. But there might
at
be,
a price, obviously.
But the price could be just time.
And the monkey paw resets.
Not for the same person.
Didn't it?
Not for the story I'm aware of.
What is your sticking point?
So my sticking point is because ownership is transferring from one to the other.
But the transaction has still already been made. It's like a legal binding contract.
But then he would have had four wishes because if make me a prince, first time around, first ownership of the lamp, he goes through the whole thing. He doesn't do anything. He wishes for his, when he regains lamp. So then technically he's got the two from the first one. Mm-hmm. There's Jafar. We got the Jafar interlude. Then you get to renewed ownership, which he would have three new wishes according to my brain. And he says, I wish yeah, I wish you were free, and then says, Genie, you're free, which would mean that he would have two from that one and two from the first one.
So I mean,
no, once he's free, everything's void.
The legal bindingness of whatever he's being held to is no longer applicable.
Yeah. And I'd also like to point out, this is slavery.
Yes, it is.
Which,
it's a
magical slavery.
Yeah. It's like, as long as we don't like, never mind. Just, we're not going to get it.
See, so, the problem is that, like, if you take that interpretation, you can then get into a racket where you're just like, I will do two wishes. It is now your lamp. You will do two wishes.
And then it passes back.
And then we back my lamp.
Which we don't know what the kind of stipulations are when it comes to.
There's no way that's allowed.
No, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Like, I'm pretty sure there's some kind of like ultimate reset for like the lamp. Once the wishes are done, then the lamp like sends itself off to another part of the world or something. We never got to that part. So that's the thing.
In that lore, yes. Because I want to bring up a movie I really liked, 1,000 Years of Longing with Idris Elba as a djinn. And he talks
about... But a djinn is not a genie.
No,
there's a very distinct difference.
But the thing is, the whole concept is Tilda Swinton is the main character in this, opposite Idris Elba, who's a djinn. She finds his bottle, this whole thing. His bottle translates through multiple like decades and eons of him being passed from owner to owner, essentially at this point. But she has this finite identification because she parallels genies with djinns. And then her entire like job in the movie is that Idris Elba is like, listen, I could go into multiple bottles. And then even then, when he has different people and he's passed from one person to the other, like the wishes do reset for them. It's weird. That's why I brought up the resetting wishes. But the new owners.
I don't know
it's
about
Idris
any of that, but remember when Shazam was in a boombox? So
that's Green Egg in Heaven.
So the thought is, so back to whatever diatribe Amy tried to put in there. Uh-huh. So back to the main focus. So do you think there's merit to the idea that Aladdin technically still had two more wishes after he became quote unquote, because ultimately what happens is because of his heroic actions, so to speak, mm-hmm. he, and mind you, this was, so just so we get an idea, this was pulled from Reddit. So yeah. Reddit's the one who, but with his heroic actions, he causes the Sultan to change the law, which then allows him to become a prince. And thus without movie part two, you know, or part three, it is left to the imagination of the viewer that he is going to be betrothed to Jasmine and become a prince. Do you feel that there is merit behind the idea that he still has two more wishes?
No. He at most has one.
Why do you say that?
Because wish number two, I don't feel is a valid wish. I never did. That was the one where he was like dying
in the water.
Ocean. Yeah. And like Genie kind of like forced his hand on that
But
one.
Again, that's still of the mindset that he had to make sure. It's like when these managers have like musical artists as you know part of their team, and they're like, okay, I'm gonna put them up here, I'm gonna get them there until they make it big, and then you know, so it's part of his investment that he needs him to ultimately succeed in becoming a prince, kind of like a Mr. Meeseeks. Let's be honest, it's ultimately like a Mr. Meeseeks. The Mr. Meeseeks doesn't get to rest or die until the task is done. The genie technically cannot move on to other things until that task is done.
Well, that just means he's locked permanently.
Yeah.
Okay. The end. Because like if he dies down there, if he dies, he dies. Cool. Just like
and now he's just tied to a dead body at the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, he can go back into his lamp though.
His lamp is with him.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm sure
at the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah. No one's gonna bother you ever again. It's fine.
So just stay stuck in a lamp. So you're for slavery is what you're saying.
No,
that's all I'm hearing. That's all I'm hearing. What about you, Ames?
That is not what I said.
We're not for slavery here.
Thank
you. Let us indentured or contractual or otherwise. No. I actually agree with Spencer because I think there's only one wish. Even if we forego my whole concept of technically he had extra wishes, the getting out of the Cave of Wonders, he gets off on like the Aladdin gets off on the technicality. Like he's like, oh, I didn't say I wished. So even then, that would have been his first one. Make me a prince would have been his second one. And then the drowning, though, Genie's like, eh, no. that's hit would have been his third one. But in releasing the genie and wishing for him to be free, he used his second wish, which means he would only have one if we forgoed my whole like fight for, you know, ownership changes.
Ownership changes.
Ownership changes.
Ownership changes.
Which, I mean, okay.
And even then he'd still have three new wishes.
Well, I mean, at that point, like, you know, if he's free, he's free.
Yeah.
Then I'd be like.
But then that's the question of, is he still contractually bound to honor those wishes because he's no longer tied to the lamp, which means he has no master, but he made the contract.
What kind of question is that?
Legalese, baby.
Like, no, like, John, do we have any more of them slaves bring back? Do the. Hey, Roger. We need you to come back for two more weeks. Can you come back? Like, no, that's not how it works.
That's how they tried to make it work in real life, though.
Exactly.
I'm just saying.
No, but that
Amy's kind of painting this not in a good light. Just like, I mean, he could have still done some work for him. I mean, just
he came back.
No, you could have paid him under the table.
Hey, just, hey,
free woman.
Calcifer returned. After he was released.
A fire demon? Yeah. We're talking about anime now? Hayao Miyazaki?
Hey, animation is animation, regardless of where it comes from. Expect, like, respect.
So Amy's for slavery is what I'm hearing.
You need to be careful with that because AI is listening and it's going to just have, like, some very fraught opinions about you.
It already does.
Amy.
What?
Well, talking about women and their interesting thoughts and opinions, we.
Not touch on that one.
We are going to jump over to
I have things to throw over here.
You
and you should.
You no, you don't.
There's
actually.
Potatoes on this table. I don't have to be strong. I just have to be accurate.
Well, apparently, speaking of Amy's opinion and being drawn to that character of Demi Moore, that does bring us to our conversation of the evening as we dive deep into the Academy Award winner and multi-award winning film of 2024. And that is
2025.
It's from 2024.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. I hate it.
Yeah.
Because the monkey was a 2025. And
yeah.
We're really just going to have to edit this thing up.
Dang it.
2024 film, The Substance. We were talking about what we were going to review this week, and as the Oscars just passed us and was rather interesting as far as who won and who didn't, and it, to be quite frank, wasn't really worth talking about, so that's why we didn't talk about it at the beginning. We decided that we wanted to talk about a movie that we feel didn't really get enough mention at the Oscars and didn't really get enough love, I think. So, yeah. So as we dive into this movie, we'll talk about all of our thoughts and opinions. But before we do, Spencer, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
Fading actress Elizabeth Sparkle becomes distressed when her chauvinistic boss fires her from her decades-long aerobic show. Hoping to find a quick solution, she injects herself with a mysterious serum, or substance, as some people might say, that promises a younger, better version of herself, but soon discovers that the price of youth may be more than she can afford.
Written, directed by Coralie Farjay, the film stars Margaret Qualley, Dennis Quaid, and the timeless Demi. I'm like, why didn't you put Demi Moore at the very top
because
of this?
Because she is top. No, right? I wanted
that's
to
top billing. Why would you? No, that's no. You could have put the timeless Demi Moore,
top
Margaret
billing.
Qualley,
she gets
and
top
Dennis-
billing.
See, this is
plus. I'm so upset with Dennis Quaid and him eating.
We'll talk about it.
A couple of key pieces of information about this movie. This is the seventh horror film nominated for the Academy Award for Best Picture. Only The Silence of the Lambs from 1991 has won to date. I don't know what the other five were, but
Get Out, Black Swan, The Exorcist, Silence of the Lambs. I'm missing like one or two.
So did you omit this just so that you have talking points for yourself?
No.
Is that what I'm understanding?
No.
That's what it seems like, Spencer.
It made it really big.
Other than this really big note that you have in here that's like half a page long.
Hey, I ran this by you before you like approved of the notes, so I don't want to hear
it. Wow, she's got receipts.
No, she doesn't. Another piece of information, Dennis Quaid was so committed to making Harvey's notorious shrimp eating scene as gross as possible, he ended up eating 4 pounds of shrimp. Ugh. Amy apparently is of the European scale here and had to put 2 kilograms, but 4 pounds of shrimp. Which
the director and writer is French, so yes.
And we are in America. So either way.
We're not doing too hot over there either, so I'm going to leave it alone. Go.
Anyway, that's a lot of shrimp, and that's... I feel bad for the camera lens at that point because
you have to clean that so often.
Are you kidding? They just had to throw it out. Just like as much as that bad boy, you know, just really kind of. Yeah. Coralie Farjay chose to omit character backstories, preferring to reveal information through actions, locations, and attire. For example, colors were written into the script to symbolize character traits. Elizabeth Sparkle's yellow jacket representing a quote-unquote superhero-like, end quote, quality before her transformation, and Sue's pink leotard signifying her femininity. The character Sue, described as blonde in a 2020 draft of the script, was given her namesake to subconsciously evoke Lolita and Marilyn Monroe, baby doll-like iconography, and classic beauty standards that continue to endure. Farjay chose the name Elizabeth for its, quote, iconic resonance, end quote, with stars of old Hollywood, and Sparkle because of its associations with happiness and to, quote, shine and be under the light, end quote. Yeah, that's a lot. But yeah, it makes sense as far as like the direction for utilize. This movie really leans heavily on its visuals. So obviously when it comes to wanting to tell the story, they wanted it to be more seen than heard. And I can understand that, especially after watching the film. last on this list, Demi Moore's Golden Globe win is the first major win in her more than 40-year career. This woman is an old head of Hollywood of the Silver Age, and she has made a name for herself in several films. Amy mentioned just one a little bit ago about
G.I. Jane. We didn't talk about Ghost.
Well, Ghost, A Few Good Men, Striptease. You know, there's a ton of movies that she's done, and it's like this is the only one that she has ever won an award for.
A major award. She didn't get any, like, and that's why it says major award, because she didn't.
What other kind of award is there within Hollywood?
I don't know if she's got a BAFTA.
That's
like
a major award.
No, I said I don't know if she's got a BAFTA. Like, literally, even when you look at her wiki, she earned a nomination in Ghost, but other than that, it doesn't look like there's anything where it's like there's nothing that says she won awards. Like, seriously, that's part of the thing that I was having problems with.
That's sad.
She's nominated for an Academy Award, a BAFTA, Directors Guild Award, and a Primetime Emmy. She's got a Critics Choice, a SAG, an Independent Spirit, and now the Golden Globe. But that's it.
And mostly everything's just been from The Substance.
Yeah, she's been nominated 52 times and has won 22. But literally, even when you look, like one Golden Globe and one Critics Choice.
Scarlet Letter.
Yeah. And one Screen Actors.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Talk about major award. Excuse me. She won 1994's MTV Movie Award for Best Kiss and Indecent Proposal. Get it right, okay? That's a major award. MTV Movie Awards were a thing.
She got a Moon Man. Yeah.
That's an MTV award.
I couldn't remember. Did
you
she
not
get
recall
a blimp?
The original?
Did she get a Nickelodeon award?
Oh yeah, she got it for Striptease. Get it right. It's like
wow.
I have such a problem with that.
She also won for apparently sexiest she-villain in the Charlie's Angels Full Throttle movie.
Was that the second one?
Maybe the third? I don't know.
I don't know that one.
She won a Razzie for Worst Supporting Actress in Charlie's Angels as well.
See, that's a major award.
As well as, oh my God, she got a Razzie Award for Worst Actress in G.I. Jane.
Yay!
And she won a Razzie for Worst Actress in The Juror. And she won a Razzie for Worst Actress in Striptease. And she won a Razzie for Worst Screen Couple in Striptease. And she got nominated for Worst Actress in The Scarlet Letter, Worst Screen Couple in The Scarlet Letter.
So in other words, as I stated, she's got a SAG award.
Well,
she's
we saw the movie. There's not.
Oh. Retract yourself, young man.
What?
We haven't even gotten there. We haven't gotten to first impressions or expectations. All I was trying to point out was the fact that this is the first Golden Globe that this woman has won.
Mm-hmm.
Great job.
After 40 years, this is the first one that she's won.
Yeah. Oh, no, she won a Saturn Award for Best Actress in Ghost.
Golden Globe.
I'm just saying. I mean, you got to give credit where credit is due, right? So as we dive into this movie, obviously we're going to be talking about spoilers as this movie has already been out for a good amount of time. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't had a chance to see it, you should check it out. It's typically either available through purchasing or renting, mm-hmm. as well as available to watch on streaming through Mubi. Mm-hmm. So you've been warned. This is your one and only alert. If I can find it, I don't know where it is. Ames, where's it at?
Set up the board.
Oh, there it is. Here we go. Spoiler alert. So, thank you, Ames.
I didn't see
you're
a
great intern. Good job. so, let's dive into this film. As we talk about, so expectations. Obviously, so truth be told, full disclosure, full transparency. We weren't too sure what we were going to talk about this week, as it was going to be Oscars week or the week after Oscars. And we didn't really want to focus on the Oscars because we've done that before. We wanted to kind of touch on one of the movies that the Oscars were going to be highlighting, so to speak. And when it came to actually watching the Oscars, there wasn't really a lot of diversity within like who was winning and whatnot. Like, obviously you had, you know, some of the mainstays that everybody thought. But to be honest, The Substance was one of those movies that I had seen last year that I thought, okay, this is a really interesting movie. And as award season began starting last year during like November and December, like it started getting a lot of attention. So I'm like, okay, well, you know, I'm glad people are seeing this. And then we get to this year and it still got some more attention with like makeup and best supporting actress and everything. And then we get to the Oscars and the Oscars are like, The Substance who? And they gave him like maybe one or two. I think it was just one.
It was for hair and makeup.
Not even special effects. Not even anything else.
The like BAFTA's got him on that one. They're like, good job, guys.
So I wanted to give it a little bit of love. And so I told you guys like, hey, let's watch this movie so that way we can, you know, review it. So as far as expectations, what were some of the things that were going through your guys' head before actually watching the movie? And I want to start with Spencer.
So I saw this movie at my grandfather's house, and so
hold the phone.
Yeah,
you watched this movie at your grandfather's house.
Well, he wasn't there at the time.
Oh, okay.
Even
okay.
Better. Good job.
I was just like, okay.
But yeah, because it was on the service that they had, so I was like, I would like to watch this because what I missed my chance. They had stuff.
They have stuff.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because I wanted to see it when it was still in theater. No, I'm not going to respond to this. I wanted to see it when it was still in theaters, but it was doing that weird thing. It got blind spotted, yes.
Yes.
Where it was just at really funky times, and I'm like, I don't want to start a movie at 10 p.m. Yep. Sorry.
Yeah.
So I didn't see it in theaters, which I was kind of bummed about, but still saw it. So I was excited to see what was really going on with this movie.
Any expectations at all?
Nope.
Okay. Ames.
Amy.
Hello. So expectations for me, to say that I wasn't really excited about this film before all the accolades came out, because I think it released in like September-ish, something like that.
Yeah.
As soon as you put the words horror and then you put it in, oh, body horror, I'm like, oh God, I don't know if I can handle that. So I was intentionally avoiding this thing like the plague, simply yes. because that's one of my sticking points for as I continue to move through exploring horror that I'm like, oh, this is really uncomfortable for me. So my expectations going into this film after hearing everybody had really, you know, they loved it. Mm-hmm. And as many wonderful things have been said about it, I was like, okay, I'm gonna take a chance. And so I was like, my expectations were like, please don't Trump scare me. And if we're bleeding out somewhere, please let me be like, it looks funny. Like your face looks funny while you're dying. Like something that I could just be like, don't haunt my dreams, please.
Oh, well, now I have to ask, did any of the visuals haunt your dreams?
Yes, they did.
Okay, hold on. I'm going to start muting you every time you start running away with that woman. Looking at you. And you.
What? How dare you, sir?
This is like my third or fourth time seeing this movie. So honestly, the first time I saw it, my biggest expectation, I guess, was this is a Cronenberg-esque movie according to people who talked about it, who saw it, it's a Cronenberg-esque movie that deeply resonated with some women. That's what I had heard coming out of the film festivals. And then it had trouble getting distributors here in the U.S., so it did get a distributor through Mubi, and it was in theaters for like 2 weeks. And then it went straight to Mubi. And I'm like, what is this? And why are people like going nuts over this? And then I saw kind of a spoiler of like one of these special effects props that was used in a meme or something. And I'm like, what is that? And so I'm like, all right, all my expectations were, I hope that it's at least good enough for me to watch the whole thing. And I need to know what that was. So those were honestly my only expectations. I had no idea what was in this. I have no idea what it was about. The it was odd because even up until that point around mid-September, the premise of it was even still like an elusive thing to me. I didn't know what it was about. I had no idea like what it was kind of surrounding, other than like, oh, someone doesn't like who they are and they want to be different. Okay. We've seen that about a million times. Heck, even Steve Urkel at one point, you know, did the same thing.
Don't bring in the transformation chamber.
I'm just saying, I mean, Stefan was, you know.
And then he was Bruce Lee at one point too.
Yep.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yep.
We're not going to go there.
They did Carl. Not treat that man well on that show.
What? Wait, wait, who? Jaleel White?
Yeah.
Have you not heard the stories?
I've heard some stories.
He was the terror on that show.
According to that Key Peele sketch.
Wait, no, I'm sorry.
Get out of my house, Steve.
No, your ultimate like favorite TV dad is the one who said that. He's gone on record several times saying, you know, yeah, you, Jaleel White was, you know, a little difficult to work with, you know, at times, and the Key and Peele skit wasn't too far off, and blah 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 blah. And it's like, okay, what are we talking about here? But he never went into any more detail. But he did say that it was pretty close. So I don't know. Not poor Urkel, poor everyone else.
Like, there was stuff that happened on that show. It was not great.
Some characters went up the stairs and never came down.
And
we'll Judy never is never to be seen again.
Nope. We don't even know her name anymore.
Nope. That's why I didn't say her name.
Wow.
So anyway,
I'm not even going to broach that. So obviously we all got a chance to see the film. First impressions right outside the gate without giving away too much. Let's start with Amy.
This wasn't as bad as I thought it was, but dang, this makes me sad and angry simultaneously. And I will like to talk about that in a larger extent in a little bit.
There you go. Spencer.
About halfway through this movie, like the biggest smile was on my face because I was like, this is amazing. And it never left. I was ecstatic.
So I made a good choice is what you're saying.
No, I've seen this movie.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, I told you at the beginning I saw it at my grandfather's house.
Yes.
I thought you had seen it just this past week.
No, I saw it like a couple months ago.
Oh, well, even better. Cool. Yeah,
I own it on Blu-ray.
You do?
Commitment. Yes.
That's how much you know I liked it.
You liked it. Very cool.
As you get physical media, we know it's serious.
That's cool. So I felt the same way. I first time I saw it, I was like, I have no idea what the heck I'm watching, and I can't turn away. And I finished the movie, and I turned, and I after the movie was done, and Amy had left for an exorbitant amount of time. And when she came back, well, you had stepped out because you were doing some things. And when you came back,
You looked at me and said, "This is great."
Well, I said it was like a train crashed into a massive collision, was on fire, and there was a cart that was full of fireworks, and it was all going off at the same time. Right. And you knew it was carnage, but you could not look away because it was just beautiful carnage. Like, this movie absolutely held my attention, held my breath, and I do not recall breathing through that whole entire last third act until the very end, like actually consciously like breathing. So yeah, but let's dive into it. So obviously the main actress of the film, Demi Moore, she was apparently in her 60s. She was 60 at the point of filming this. Mm-hmm. So the fact that, number one, she was 60 and she looked like that. Number two, she was 60 and she looked like that.
She's 60 and she looks like that. She's not
60. She still looks the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. It's like the woman doesn't age.
I think that's the thing that's perplexing to him, that she can still look so lovely.
Well, some people just like, you know, they just carry it and then they'll reach a point where it just blah, blah, blah.
Like in The Substance.
And then they'll die. And
well, I don't know about that.
Don't witch of the waste this.
Well, no. She's fine. She's going to be fine for like decades.
But the fact is like the amount of physicality that we knew her to do within other films, like obviously movies like even in, as far as like with Ghost, with G.I. Jane, with Striptease, with like a lot of her movies that require her to be as physical as she needs to be in the film, this was one of those movies where on a whole different level, like she was so physically engaged in everything that was going on that it wasn't just a performance of like movement or whatever, but even like on her, like facially, she was active. Like, you know, her body, you know, the way she would hunch over and do this particular pose, or the way she was, you know, active in looking like that. Like, the fact is that the woman put in the work in this movie. Mm-hmm. And again, for an actress who has over 40 years of, you know, putting into this industry, to see that this woman barely got recognized for this, and not that this was a bad performance, but that like everything that she's done, it's almost like the whole Leonardo DiCaprio thing again, where, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio didn't get recognized until what was that movie? The one where he's by Alexander Inarritu, Alejandro Inarritu, The Revenant. The Revenant. How he didn't get recognized by the Academy or anyone else until that movie, when he had a whole plethora of work underneath him that he was more than, you know, capable of winning an award for that. This is like such a shock to me that as great as she was in this movie, this woman has been putting in the work for years. I don't know why, number one, they're just giving it to her now, and number two, why they're just giving it to her now, like just plain and simple. But she was phenomenal in this movie. And I feel like at that point in time, like with the subject material of the film and where I'm pretty sure Demi Moore is at currently in her life, like there's some overlap. I mean, let's be honest. There's a little bit of probably overlap with where she's at in life and where the character's at currently in that story. And so the sense of like honesty and transparency was more so, I feel like, there and visible with everything she was doing on stage or on screen. I feel like this was probably if not one of the best performances by her, but I feel like still she should have gotten something before that, you know. Yeah. I feel like there should have been some kind of, you know, more recognition on her part for her career prior to.
Yeah, and she's closer just kind of going through things. Oh, I forgot she's the voice of Esmeralda in Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Yeah.
She's closer actually to 45 years since originally she started on General Hospital in like 81-ish.
What was she on General Hospital?
She was a reoccurring character for like 2 or 3 years. And then she had like a small part in a movie called Choices in 81. And then she had, like, it started picking up later. She had No Small Affair, Blame It in Rio, and then St. Elmo's Fire. Mm-hmm. And then it starts really picking up from there.
Hey, she did a sequel to Hunchback of Notre Dame, too.
Yeah. It's Esmeralda. You can't really, like...
Disney does it all the time.
They do.
They literally recast Robin Williams as the genie, since we were talking about Aladdin earlier, with the guy who did Homer Simpson in the second one. So... Don't look at me like that.
I can look at you like whatever I want. But I do agree that Demi Moore, in not only the commitment to the role, but I think the personal struggles that she faced in just not only did she identify with Elizabeth Sparkle, but like the entire, it felt like the story was as much about her as it was for her. Mm. And there was such, we talk about raw honesty in performances. I feel like it's outplayed, but when you say it and you mean it, there's only so many performances that you can actually tack those into that like column, And 100%, this was very raw,
very vulnerable
and very earnest. And that's something too, when we talk about, there's a lot of nudity in this film. I almost said nudity.
Nudity.
But the thing is that it's not used in a way that is intent. It's used with a purpose. And that's, it's in juxtaposition to striptease.
Yeah.
Versus this. And thinking about who she played in striptease and then seeing her in this. Again, we're talking about earnesty and vulnerability and commitment to craft and all of these things where she, there wasn't, it, they, everything, like if you read in the trivia, they don't use doubles.
No.
And the fact is she stood there and in everything, it's just like, it's so beautiful. She's beautifully heartbreaking because it's, take so much to say this is how I look.
Yeah.
And we're looking at in the film what she's supposed to be in her 40s.
She's supposed to be in her 50s. She technically is turning 50 because that's
it's
when
her birthday right at the beginning.
Because that's what what's his name says, you know, at 50, you know, it stops. And she's what stops? And he goes, "What?" He goes, "What stops?" And he doesn't have an answer. But the film is supposed to be surrounding the fact that she turns 50. And so she's aged out, quote unquote, by Harvey. But no, I mean, to your point, like exactly the fact that this woman who has given her all for the craft, absolutely given her all for this industry to create art, to create one of a kind, unique instances in cinematic history for audiences worldwide, to not only endure with the character, but to also have those vulnerable moments of this is me right now. Mm-hmm. You know, I shudder at the thought of like being in that situation of having, you know, a huge film camera be so close on your body to get all those blemishes, so to speak, like in all the parts of your body that nobody really wants anybody to focus on. And they had cameras close on all her, you know, on all parts of her body, you know, and to have that kind of amplified and magnified on a huge silver screen and to have the confidence in your creative team and the director to take those and make sure that it is not to, you know, put any kind of disposition on what people look like, but to ensure that people understand there's bravery in the choice to make that scene happen.
Yeah.
Well, it's also sacrifice too. And we can talk about even the way when, you know, we transition over with the substance. That there are large swaths of scenes.
Am I going to have you start doing the opening part of the show since you're going to do your movie voice now? The substance.
No, I was just, Spencer did a really good job.
You could replace John.
I could not. I appreciate the confidence, the vote of confidence,
you
but
know,
I could not.
Here's a thought, real quick. We should start having Amy do the movie voice when she and have her replaced, you know, instead of you doing the opening, the synopsis, we should have Amy do the movie voice.
Oh, yeah.
In a world.
I can't do that one.
It's okay. You can do it closely.
But talking about vulnerability and sacrifice, in a large swath of those scenes, Demi Moore is literally on the ground, wholly naked in varying scrunched up awkward positions, and those are not pretty by any stretch of the imagination, and it's almost like she's purposely set that way, and you can't kind of tell where is it in the writing or was it her that decided like she's going to be crumpled this way or she's going to be flipped that way, or and so I was like, questions.
You know what's really interesting about this performance is a lot of her performance when she's not speaking speaks volumes. Like there's like one specific scene where she's just getting ready for a date and I was heartbroken during that whole thing, and she didn't even utter a word during that whole sequence, and so I've really just so like she connected with this source material in just such a way that just brought this story to life, like,
that
truly
that entire scene from like the moment she calls him to the scene where she's sitting on the edge of her room and the messages are just flooding in, that in itself is a short film. Completely conveys so much emotion, and there's very little dialogue except for at the beginning of that scene when she's on the phone with him, and even then that's very minimal. But the entire like conveyance of, you know, of that journey from, you know, some self-confidence and excitement to ultimately the farthest opposite side of that spectrum of, you know, just completely, you know, down and despising of herself and just out of gas, essentially, like out of any type of, you know, momentum or motivation to leave and go do anything. It's so accurately portrayed and just really well done. I mean, for lack of a better term, like she is absolutely incredible at that. And again, I'm pretty sure that there are multiple scenes out there in other films where she's probably done just as well, if not better. And we are just recognizing it now. Like it messes with my head when I think about the history of cinema and how much more movie makers and Hollywood industry type people looked at the majority of like what men are doing in the industry and what male, you know, actors and whatnot have done at this point. And there's a lot more, there's a lot of people who speak more towards like, oh, men have built this industry and blah, blah, blah. But then you look at all the people who gone before them and the people who had built the archetypes of what the female actresses of today, you know, with people like Elizabeth Taylor, like some of your favorites, Ames. Yeah.
Like which ones? Because I love Lauren Bacall too. But you've got Marilyn Monroe. Mm-hmm. I mean, even
because I figured I could keep going on about this, but I'd figure I'd hand it over to
you. You can give me some, but it's also like there's people that when we look at them, they're
like people like Jamie Lee Curtis, people like, you know, Sally Field, actresses like, you know, Barbara Streisand, actresses like there's so many people who have, you know, built this entire industry.
Well, Jane Fonda too.
Fonda.
But this is, and even if we're kind of jumping ahead because we haven't finished talking about the cast, but Jane Fonda, this parallels and almost kind of moves with what Jane Fonda's story was, because she went from actress to selling aerobic tapes. So like, if you think of it almost in that way too,
a certain extent. And then she went to advocacy and you know, activism, but,
which I mean, could have been an option for Elizabeth Sparkle.
She didn't get that far.
But we didn't get there.
I say it just because the fact is that we can sugarcoat it all we want, but the truth is that this industry is a male-driven industry and has been for half a millennia. Like and
Dorothy L'Amour. Sorry.
No, but I mean, you know, even you mentioned Dorothy and immediately made me think of like Judy Garland, like even a lot of the actresses of old, you know, what is her name? So the actresses that have built this cinematic monolith of what we now enjoy every day and what we see in the archetypes that are built. And the fact is, I mean, if we look at the history of it, men have inundated and overwhelmed this industry so that they are the only ones who pat themselves on the back. And I mean, it's so obvious now, but back in the day when people were less, you know, aware and more obtuse to like what's going on, but like that's how we ended up with, you know, people like Harvey Weinstein, people like, you know, we literally get.
You think that's why his name is Harvey?
I was going to say.
Probably.
I just pieced that together.
No, I have no doubt.
But we're also talking about that this is the exposure of people like that. You're looking even farther back, the prevalence of the movie industry and women. It is a meat grinder for women.
Unless 100%. Judy Garland died because of this industry.
My brain went to Mae West, who literally, mm-hmm. not only did she create an archetype and a trope for the haughty, like slightly naughty woman, she literally went out and was like, well, I have money now, I'm going to do what I want. And she was still butting up against the entire like scope that she had been the hole in the box that they had put her in and said, you can only play this type of person.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing happened to Marilyn Monroe consistently. But if we're talking about Harvey, because we do need to get back on track with the casts.
No. So last thing, just to state, because
we're going to get into that with all the story too.
Okay. But last thing is just the fact is that we have been so inundated with the fact that women are the accoutrement and not the main dish. They are the sidekick and not the main hero. They are the, you know, the, you know, accessory and not the actual package. we are so of that mindset that for the last 30, 40 years, people assume that if a woman is on screen, it's because she's playing a wife. She's playing a mom. She's playing, the love interest. She's playing the mistress, and it's never
seductress.
And the fact is that this is her career is ultimately a symptom of the fact of everything that has happened thus far. Like, she is the victim when it comes to recognizing these people. And I feel like we should give more attention to that and be more mindful of that now, especially with more and more female actresses and filmmakers coming up in that. But speaking of Harvey, going to Harvey. So moving on to the other character that actually really created a exuding of emotion. Dennis Quaid.
Not Randy.
He's
Don't
not Randy.
You dare say Randy Quaid.
Randy Quaid.
That would have been even more uncomfortable.
Randy Quaid, who's ran off to Canada because he can't be in America because he's been he's in trouble. He's in
he's in trouble.
I believe it's like tax evasion or some stuff like that, and that's why he's living in Canada or something. Who knows? But either way, Dennis Quaid is in this movie, and I tell you this. I love Dennis Quaid. I love the movies that he does. But this movie, he played too good of a bad guy.
Oh,
like, he played too good of a despicable person. And I'm sincerely just chalking it up to him just being a really great actor, because the fact is, this man
was too on point.
Everything that he said, everything that he did, every close-up that they had of him, every single instance.
His mouth was so big.
Just back off.
Just a little bit.
Just scooch. Even the camera work on just being too close, I feel like really actually filled in his character of he seems like the type of guy who would just get up in a woman's face and start talking. Yeah.
But you also understand the reason why the focus is on his mouth so much, right? He's the mouth of the industry. Mm. He is the conduit as to which the higher ups speak through, and he just happens to be what it looks like. So when they show the mouth, it's because he's just doing what he's being told by the higher ups. Ultimately, in that same mindset, I'm assuming, and this is just my take, mm-hmm. but I feel like that character is ultimately just, we are so used to and of the mindset that every single horrible person who portrays that, who looks like this, whether they're in Hollywood or whatnot, they look like this and they act like this. But we tend to forget that all those types of people, they were groomed and created by other people / someone else to be that for that role, for that particular position. And in this case, he was just the mouthpiece to other interests and whatnot.
What you do see in the third act when they have the board behind him, and then they run down the hallway after those other women, and they do the little skippy whatever, which was to be honest, the third act was hilarious. even as much as I was sad and mortified, there was parts that I was like, this is so funny. But that moment when we see him in the hallway where he's like, oh yes, you look great. It simultaneously felt like he was on speed and that he couldn't figure out what was going on. And he was just going to keep talking until he had you believing whatever he needed you to believe because you were going to go along with his plan. And it's very indicative, again, of the entertainment industry just feeding into this constant, if we can hit you with enough, especially being a woman, if we can hit you with enough information, if we can keep talking at you, you're going to get tired, or you're just going to nod your head and go along with it because you don't know what's going on. And not only did he embody it really, really well, it was just... we needed to pull back so many times from this man. I agree with you, Spencer, so hard.
It was a lot.
That's the nice way to say it,
Spencer. Yes, it is.
Pertaining to just his performance altogether, or
the not only his performance was great. And mm-hmm. I think the problem was his performance was the so good. It's that terrible juxtaposition, I hated you so much. You did a really good job acting.
Yeah.
And in everything else where you've seen, Dennis Quaid, just be cheerful, polite Dennis Quaid, or endearing. And you see this and I'm
where's the dad from The Rookie? No. Where's the dad from The Rookie?
Parent Trap. Where's the dad from The Parent Trap?
It's the mindset I have every time I think of Joaquin Phoenix. The first thing I ever saw him in was Gladiator. And I hated him because he was so good at being that horrible guy in Gladiator that I was there's no way this guy can be good in anything else. And I literally, I think I immediately after that saw like Signs and I was like, you're good, but I don't like you. It is like Meryl, swing at your head. Like, it's like, I was upset, but still impressed by his role in that. And it's like, people are the I guess heavy crown that is for great actors is that when they play horrible people, they play horrible people really well. Yeah. And when they play great people, they play great people really well as well. So you're like, okay, I love him as a superhero. I love him as the brother. I love him as this. I love him as that. Oh, he's playing the villain. Oh, he's playing the evil emperor. Oh, he's playing the mischievous this or whatever. And it's like, okay. Like we just recently saw, well, Amy had just recently seen the movie Bad Times at the El Royale.
Ooh, such a good one.
Such a good one.
And mind you.
Unexpected. Again. Yes. That had really crappy marketing.
It did. It really did. But it's a great movie. And it was during a time when Chris Hemsworth was really only mostly known for his roles in Marvel and then maybe his roles in the god-awful Ghostbusters movie that we don't speak of. But
yeah, no, you're right, because that was right before that.
Yeah, but
I would have wanted to do what he did as well.
But the fact is that in this movie, he was despicable and he was so just heartless and manipulative. And it's like from the perspective of somebody who has seen it, I'm pretty sure it makes it even worse that how good he portrayed it. And it's like, my God, Chris Hemsworth, you are great at playing a horrible person. And so it's like, you're then like, then you go back to like to the next Thor movie and you're like, you kill people. Like,
if you go to Thor Love and Thunder after watching Bad Times at the El Royale, you're like,
you don't look at it the same. It's just what you,
man, you're living a lie somewhere.
You would have killed those kids.
You would have let them go. Yeah.
But ultimately, like Dennis Quaid, I've actually met Dennis Quaid before, and I got a chance to talk to him at when I was working for the radio network. And he had just done, I Can Only Imagine, the movie, I Can Only Imagine. And he was actually backstage at the Grand Ole Opry with us, hanging out, and we were all talking. It was like him, I forget the name of that country singer, but there was a country singer there as well. And we were talking to him, and he was just the nicest guy. He was so sweet. He was kind to everybody. He was like, yeah, you know, oh, you really like them. Oh, that's really great. I'm really glad you like that movie. That's a great movie. I have great memories of it. Blah, 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 blah. He was fun. He was amazing.
And now this.
And I'm like,
dear Dennis,
I never want to see you eat shrimp in public again.
Truly, oh, Lord. If we could enact an unfair law, I would like to ban him from eating shrimp for the rest.
We
of the
should
life.
Like or, in,
head,
or
head on and head off. No. There's no. You have no option of getting like, oh, I'm gonna have a little. No shrimp.
And it's not even that. It's more so like if he's gonna eat it, wear a veil. Like just put a hood over or something.
But then there's gonna be the sounds. Like
we don't have to be in the same room. I just know, the man what? Picks up if, the if man Dennis picks up Quaid a crustacean eats- from across the city. I can see it. I will feel it.
No, see,
like
I'm
the little
gonna,
shrimp,
gonna,
like red a baby and
from Shark Tale.
From Shark Tale.
See, my thing is, if I can't see him and I can't hear it, it's gonna be like the if a tree falls in a wood and nobody hears it.
If a tree falls in a wood,
yes, like the 100-acre wood.
Yes, and nobody hears it. Did it actually fall? Like, or does it make a sound? So if he's eating shrimp somewhere that I don't know where he is, I'm just gonna let it.
There's actually a movie called The Wood that's about Inglewood. So
yeah, I know.
Or Brentwood. Is it, which one is it?
I thought it was Inglewood.
Is and
it Inglewood?
Then my brain goes to The Woods, which is a comic book. So we're all good. But we have one more person that really kind of rounds out this very
Margaret
small
Qualley.
It's ooh. So hard to just like stop gushing about each of these people.
Exactly.
But the fact is, I mean, they are amazing. I mean, if you look at the parentage of Margaret Qualley, she already comes from, you know, incredible performers such as Andy McDowell. I forget who her dad is.
Yeah, he's another one.
But Andy McDowell.
Sorry.
Andy McDowell, popular actress of the 80s and 90s. Phenomenal actress. And her daughter is Margaret Qualley. And she's actually gotten a little bit of attention in like some of the more fun, interesting like ads. Like she did an ad. I forget the one where she's like dancing maniacally through like a whole entire hall of mirrors or something. But it's really great. And it's actually really fun. But she was just phenomenal in this movie. And the fact is like, you, if you're going to create a secondary persona of what you feel if Demi Moore had a second life and was able to restart, how would you do it? This was a very interesting way to go about doing it. And I feel like Margaret Qualley did the absolute best she did in all her efforts, and it was truly something to behold.
Yeah, I can honestly say she, like, even kind of learning about her, but she came with such an effervescence that she simultaneously, you could feel, because again, spoilers, we've already sold you spoilers, you know, she is literally the 25-year-old virgin of Demi Moore's character. And she carries the effervescence. She carries the light. Like, she carries simultaneously the innocence and the hope of everything that comes with being young and being and going into like the entertainment business. But she also, like, I found it really funny that one of the facts is she's a trained ballerina. And when she came to set, mind you, she's 29 when they were filming. She's part of the inspiration to help or to help Demi Moore feel comfortable being nude, because they both were. But she had to get prosthetic breasts because she wasn't built the way that they wanted her to be, which I'm like, OK, I guess, again, we're having that problem that you don't look like they're expecting you to, but you need to for a film to make it work. But she carried spontaneity. Another one, very earnest, very excited, very genuine in her performance. And then when we get to that final, we get to that third act.
Real quick before you get there, she was in that Fosse Verdon film. Is it a film?
It's a, or a limited, series. It's a limited series with Sam Rockwell and Michelle. I cannot remember your last name, but you're
Williams?
Pledgers. Yes.
Spencer's last name?
I couldn't remember Michelle's last name because she was partners with Heath Ledger before he died.
Yes, but she played Anne Reinking.
Oh,
but go ahead. Sorry, I just wanted to.
No, she did great. Then
because that's the only other like form of reference that I have for any other films. I didn't see it.
She was also and apparently
she was in Once Upon a Time.
Poor Things too, but I don't know exactly who she was in there. She might have been the second. The second one that was
oh
built.
yeah the second one that they built
but yeah, so there's this earnesty, again, another vulnerability. There's also such great spaces of rage that come with her too, and like this lust and greed for life, and then the justifications. But when we get to that third act, there's the conversation that she was actually the person in there in the third act. And she said that it was, we'll get to it, but that it was utter torture, but she had so much fun. Like,
oh yeah, I thought that was her.
Yeah. Like, because, looking it up. Because it's the eyes, like everything. And you're like, oh, it really is you. Yeah. Like, man.
I had no idea that, no, that she was the person inside. I was actually thinking about it while we were talking earlier. I'm like, I wonder who was the stunt person who had to do that, because I'm pretty sure it was massive amounts of latex or a whole bodysuit.
Oh, it was but her.
I assumed it was her because it's only fair. Like, Demi had to put on that like whole thing.
Yeah. The hair and the teeth, the finger and the knobby knee.
That knobby knee
was hardcore.
No, that like bothered my actual leg when I saw that. I was like, oh, gosh.
Which time?
Like, just when she was running down the hall and fell the first time.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
No, as somebody who has, like, knees issues from, like, football and all that, like, that first time when she's sitting in the chair and she sees the present on the shelf and she decides to get up and she can't get up because her knee's locked, that part hurt me physically. Like, I watched it, I'm like... I started like rubbing my knees. I'm like, oh my God, I feel it. I'm
I was
like,
just
no.
Thinking about that, I started rubbing my knees. I'm
exactly.
Like, no.
Yeah, honestly, like the cast, the main cast of this film was phenomenal.
Yes.
And it needs to be said that this movie needs people to see it. Like it absolutely is one of those movies where you watch it and you're like, oh my God, I don't think I can ever be the same again after seeing this movie. And a lot of it is due because of the nature of the story. I mean, it's as simple as it sounds. The execution of it is so unparalleled, you know, in the way that it goes about, you know, creating this tale of two cities, so to speak, like this, you know, unbridled, you know, female Jekyll and Hyde kind of aspect to it. Why are you scrumpling your nose over there?
It's more Portrait of Dorian Gray than it is like a Tale of Two Cities. Sorry. The nerd in me went there.
The portrait doesn't, you know, actively have issues. And then it doesn't go back to the portrait to live and then back to the person.
Yeah, but the portrait actively does get thrown away and hidden and everything, you know, that you decide to indulge.
We did not clear spoilers for Dorian Gray.
Portrait of Dorian Gray's been around for literally decades, if longer not a couple millennia. Yeah.
But it's more so of like this complex Jekyll and Hyde-esque type of thing. Because ultimately, Demi Moore is an aging star who the only left claim to fame that she has is a broken star on the Walk of Fame and a aerobic show that she is, you know, really good at, to be honest. And then comes to find out that Dennis Quaid, who is Harvey, who now that I've had time to think about it, I'm more than certain is a you know, plot device for Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, it makes sense.
It makes 100% sense. Ultimately says really mean things about her and says that they're going to replace her because she's old.
She overhears him too. That's the thing, that he never even kind of says it to her face. She goes to the bathroom because the women's room is out, and she walks in and she's like, oh, I can just use the bathroom. And she overhears him. And so it's like, she knows it's coming.
Yeah.
Like, that's the worst. And you know, he was never going to say, listen, you're old and we can't use you anymore.
Well, and the crazy thing is, right after that, they have lunch.
And she has one line.
And he didn't wash his hands.
Oh, God. Oh,
and he's eating shrimp.
That was right. And the twisty head shrimp, too.
And he's touching on him with his pee-pee hands.
God, now I don't want to.
Spencer, pee-pee hands.
To be honest, I do agree with the movie. He would be the type to do that.
Yeah, he would. and so ultimately, in the course of all that, Elizabeth Sparkle ends up in an accident, gets checked out by the doctor. A young male nurse says she's a good candidate, slips something in her pocket. She gets acquainted with the substance and, like every good marketer out there, slips her a little USB drive.
By the way, bad cybersecurity people. Stick in random USB drives.
It just had a phone number on the back of it. I would have been like, call the phone number.
But it's the 21st century. Nobody just calls a number. You have to have internet connectivity.
Your AI robot call.
This
the
was a digital
for you.
Press kit. Amy, get with the program.
Didn't come in a shiny box with a present.
It doesn't have to.
But I wanted to.
So she sees it. She realizes, blah 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 blah. Decides to do it, and then.
She back and forths first, though. She initially is like, I don't really think so. And then it takes like, what, a day and some change. And then she's like, do you know what? Oh, she's reading the newspaper. So it goes for a couple of days and she's reading the newspaper. And then she sees that they're putting up the audition for her show. And she's like, I want to see what's on the flash drive.
Well, okay. I mean, that's the long route, but I was just kind of trying to cut through different elements. She ends up deciding to do it. Doesn't realize that it's ultimately her splitting a part of herself to create a whole secondary part of herself.
To be fair, that press kit did not really explain.
Oh, no, without a doubt. It was the worst.
Needed to come in a box.
And then not to mention, who gives the paracord to sew people up with? It was essentially a paracord. And it's like, am I wrong?
Yeah,
military lady over here. Was I wrong?
No, it was a version of paracord. But the thing is also that the wound, again, there's some suspended disbelief in there because
where's her spine? Where'd it go?
And with the blood, where did the rest of the blood go?
I mean, yeah.
I gave respect and space for it, but yes. Also it gives that how grotesque it is. It's like
the funny thing is, Spence, we were so mind you, again, backtrack to when we were first talking about what we were going to talk about. We were still trying to figure it out. And I told you, okay, we'll watch the Oscars and see what gets mentioned and we'll talk about it.
Yes.
The first opening to the Oscars is an homage with Conan O'Brien, who was the host of the Oscars, coming out of Demi Moore. It's the whole scene again, but he comes out of Demi Moore.
And he lost a shoe.
And he loses a shoe, and he has to dive back into Demi Moore to go find his shoe.
And then he does the whole arm out with his shoe. He's like, I got it.
And so we watch that, and Amy's like, is that how it is? I'm like, yeah, that's pretty much how it is. I'm like,
okay, then I can watch this. She goes, okay.
And I'm like, I'm not going to tell her anything else. So I was like, okay. So, but it's like, the premise for the movie is so scientifically outlandish. It's yes. absolutely sci-fi, science fiction, but the nature of it and the importance that it places on having balance and almost like this kind of mantra on like, you know, work-life balance kind of thing. Like, okay, you play this much, you work this much, you play this much. And it's like, and it's echoed throughout the entire movie. And then, you know, it ultimately ensues in chaos, as most of these stories typically do. I get what you said. We ultimately get lead up to the third and final act, which then sees everything just completely implode, and it just ends in a glitter of gold and a puddle of red. Let me just put it that way.
It's an explosive finale.
It was a very explosive finale. This story though, Amy, you were mentioning how you wanted to talk more about how the story aligns with Demi Moore's life. You were mentioning, cause we were talking about it earlier, you're like, I wouldn't talk about it later. So what were you wanting to bring up? Cause now that we've mentioned the kind of basic overlay of the story
where we also neglected that Sue is the thing that comes out of Demi Moore, and she's 25 years old. She goes to the audition. She immediately gets picked up. It's sexy, younger, blah, blah, blah. And you have this lack of balance because the substance, the person on the phone for the substance tells you, remember, you are one, respect the balance. And everyone's like, I don't care what that means. And Sue, you know, really kind of like hurts it, which is weird how she gets upset at Demi. Anyway, when we're looking at the totality of this film, we're looking at the way not only society, but the entertainment industry takes women in, puts them on a platform, elevates them oh so high, and then as soon as they hit an expiration date, whoever decides that expiration date looks like whatever mm-hmm. or whenever, they are immediately disposed of. There is no, you know, aftercare. There is no second thought. They disappear. I think this is best represented in her star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. We mm-hmm. see it at the creation. We see it at the pinnacle when it's still beautiful. We watch as it's slowly deteriorating, and then the cracks keep getting bigger and they multiply, and nobody ever comes to fix those cracks. Or there's like nobody's, you know, bending down to take a picture with the star. It's just there. It exists, but she doesn't fully exist like within the world herself anymore. And then we're struggling against the, like, me as a woman, this concept of aging gracefully. Like, you can't really have an expectation of like, there is no way in this film that the concept of aging gracefully is not the, I guess, the caution, accepting aging gracefully and accepting that you are going to have to move on as a woman, and that you cannot recapture or reclaim everything that's going on with your hope, desire to be loved. It's simultaneously, she's in the spot where she doesn't love herself and she loves herself, which is the problem. The lack of balance is essentially because she doesn't love and respect herself for who she is, because she's constantly chasing that high of being the person, being the one.
But I also think a lot of it is due also to the structures that have been, as we mentioned earlier, kind of like how Hollywood has been a male-driven industry, and I think a lot of the character...
Let's cut even to that. It's not just Hollywood. It's society, period.
No. But I know. Yes, as a whole. But we're talking specifically about Hollywood, because this is kind of where this story's universe revolves around. But yes, as a whole, you know, it is a men-driven world that is slowly becoming more recognizing of all sides. But in the case of this film, the focus is because the structure of, you know, Elizabeth's world, the structure of every single person in that is that men are superior. That it is a men-driven world. It is a men-led world. And that in spite of whatever else is going on, men will dictate the direction of how the world turns.
Not to say men are superior, but yes, everything.
Well, no, it is
that.
Because even
it's not
even
a superiority in, thing. It's, it is it's because a control even thing.
No, no, no. It's not a control thing. It's a. We're talking about a movie who ultimately men choose to do what they want. They say what they want. They manipulate how they want. Because
but does that make you superior? Really?
Superior or complex?
Yeah, but yeah. It doesn't make you superior. It doesn't make they you the better that, creature.
I'm not saying that they are superior. I'm saying that they think they're superior.
No, anyway, I agree with you. With the
anyway,
superiority
so
complex
whatever. So in the mindset of this film, it's like the ultimate premise of it is just the fact that Demi Moore's character has to work within the confines of the structures that are currently in play, which are that men are better, according to the men's perspective. Men are better. They lead the world. They drive things. And so they are the only people who deserve to be in charge. And that's kind of the structure by the, it's kind of like history books are written by the victors. Like in this case, the rules are dictated by those who are in power, and those that are in power are mostly men because they put themselves in power. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how the mindset goes. And in this particular case, the framework that she lives in is that she is subject to whatever the men that she works for, because it's not a work with, mm-hmm. she's subject to whatever they want and however they want to do it.
Yeah.
And that's the nature of that kind of structure for her, which is why like operating in that, I don't even know if it's a sense of like self-worth or anything, because it's more so of recognizing the fact that the system is flawed. And even if it's that, you know, that's just part of the mindset and mentality for the overall like structure of the world. It's just a microcosm of the symptoms of the overall arching structure of the world. But I feel like that's the main message here.
Well, and also you have to kind of think about the fact that once Sue comes out and the guy on the phone for the substance, he keeps telling you like you are one, she is her, you are her, she is you. It's trying to remind you that you're the same. You are literally the same coin. And so you see in a way too that Sue has already figured out, I know what to do to make them want me. I know what to do to get ratings. I know what to do. And essentially she weaponizes her femininity to get what she wants, a la Lolita, which we talked about in the open, because that's part of, you know, I'll get what I want and you'll pay attention to me. And then we start having that butt heads against the balance of like, do you at the one point where we see the old guy that's essentially the nurse, and he's like, has she started taking from you? Like,
no, has she started eating at you? He goes, has she started yet? And she goes, has she what? He goes, has she started eating at you? And that's when she gets out. But like the very like presence of what she does and what she drives, the fact is that even if you're looking at it as like a reawakening, if you will, of someone's self-worth and you know their value and whatnot in being able to balance, okay, I am capable, I am worthy, I am X, Y, and Z, while also maintaining your sense of self of I am independent, I am unique, I am however, and then trying to make sure that that balance occurs where you don't push the gas on either side one too many. I feel like that's kind of where this is leading towards, like the story in terms of recognition of what the message is behind it. But either way, like the nature of Margaret Qualley's character, she ultimately realizes she just wants more time to be in that framework. And mind you, I'm assuming the same when they talk about the balance, the mindset is still the same in both people, like the frame of mind, the control, I guess, because she ultimately just jumps from one vehicle to the next. In my thoughts, I still don't fully grasp, like in terms of, is it a fully independent person, in each body, or is it, you know, a part of who consciously the other person is in each person?
I feel like what the movie's trying to go for is like, once the substance has been taken, like Sue has all of her knowledge to that point, and then they split because they're separate.
Mm. So it's like autonomy altogether on one end.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think, Ames? Because you're over there thinking.
No, I mean, and that's kind of a little bit of conundrum, because we see when they do that initial transfer, it's the lights and the sound and everything. So you have all of that knowledge, like you stated, up to that point. And then you start making the new memories, but they have that problem when every time whoever wakes up, it's like, what is she doing? Why is she like this? Like Sue waking up, which you find that Demi, Elizabeth Sparkle's character, keeps being consistent about, even though she knows like it's supposed to be fair. And she sits there and she has like an entire chicken and everything else. And then when Sue wakes up, she gets so mad about it. And I've been struggling because I was like, well, didn't you know she was going to do that anyway? And she was having a conversation with, again, the voice for the substance. This guy had a lot of like just silent airtime. I appreciate him. She's like, she's sitting here for a week and all she's doing is eating and watching TV. Like it's this, I don't even know if it's the rivalry of it or the fact that she's mad that she gets to sit home and eat the whole chicken.
I think it is because she's like, I work my butt off, you know, this entire time, blah, blah, blah. And she just sits at home and is eating and watching. That's what she says, because she's like, I'm working really hard and blah, blah, blah.
Which I don't fully get, because she knows the stakes.
Yeah.
Like, she should know that, like with Elizabeth's backstory, like, there's nowhere for her to go, really.
Yeah.
And it's also funny, while watching this, I was like, man, if I was doing this, I would have had like video pen pal thing going on.
Yeah.
Because that just would like fix so many problems. I'd be video like, this pen. Is my week. You got these messages. I hope things are going well.
It's a private YouTube account, just that you are the only person who have the password to. Like, so it's a Tuesday. We're trying teriyaki today. I'm going to leave some in the fridge for you when you come back. Blah, blah, blah.
Just remember the cleaner's coming today, so you have to make sure that we clean up. And please, the guy on the bike, I threw his helmet away. I don't know where his number is. Sorry.
What do you guys feel like? Like, with this, it's interesting because, like, we're talking about, like, the structure of this plot device and the switch and whatnot. What do you guys surmise the balance is? Because I've been trying to figure out, like, what are they trying to say as a filmmaker? What do you feel like the balance is trying to allude to? Because, like, some people could look at it as kind of, like I mentioned, like a work-life balance. Other people could take it as, like, a balance of oneself, aligning, you know, the parts of you that, you know, work together in tandem. Other people would look at it and say, like, oh, it's a partnership or you know, even a marriage or a relationship, you know, or it's, some people could look at it and say, you know, it's ultimately like living with a roommate. Like there's a sense of dependency, but also a sense of respect required and appreciation needed to make the, or I guess rewind that, reverse it. Yeah. Just
Willy Wonka.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm wondering, like, what are your guys' thoughts? Like, I look at it and I'm like, I feel like I lean more towards like the filmmaker talking about the delicate balance of like ultimately like oneself, one's inner being, you know, aligning like the mental, emotional, physical part of yourselves and being okay with where you're at. Like, but then I really look at it and I'm like, well, then why did she have to take the substance? Why couldn't she just have that alignment for herself? But then,
because she never had the alignment to begin with.
But then that's what I'm saying, though, is the substance, taking the substance, like the acknowledgement of knowing you need to align and now you're putting in the work? Is it like, well, accepting the need for therapy? Or like,
it's a great question. I'm just kind of
like,
put out there.
What is your guys' thoughts?
Okay. I kind of got, it was like from a perspective of like, the substance is giving you the opportunity to like confront yourself, basically, because like I really did think of this as like, you know, the problem of like inner balance with oneself, because like before this whole thing started, like it was you know, she's self-destructive, but like it's not as easy to see. Yeah. But once Sue shows up, it becomes incredibly easy to see.
Yeah.
So I always got the vibe, it was, you know, inner balance, and the substance is the way that you can see your own balance. Because, like, to be perfectly honest, I feel like this woman does not like herself. Like,
no, when 100%.
When you, like, look at it from a zoomed out lens. And it's really, like, that whole, like, date scene thing that just, like, blew that wide open for me.
And here's the thing. Mm. My question is, did she always not like herself, or was it the catalyst of hearing what Harvey said be the reason why she starts not liking herself? Like, obviously there are certain mindsets where it's like you're kind of oblivious until you're no longer oblivious, where maybe, because obviously that star is not far from her home. We know that because she walks that road often. We just never see the street up until she's walking back away from there.
Yeah.
And we never really see her. Well, you know, who knows? But the fact is, she knows of the state of it, right?
She would have to. But then here's also the thing. We talked about at the top of the show that there's lack of backstory on purpose.
Yeah.
Because if we can automatically tell that she has never really liked herself, we're like, oh, she's taking the substance.
Because it makes it easier for the decision.
Because we're trying to do that. But that's why I pointed out that she has a pause before she puts in the tape for the substance. Because somewhere...
You mean the USB?
Yeah. It could be a tape.
This isn't the ring.
I wanted
this. This is
7 days.
Right?
But she has...
Demi Moore is calling on the phone.
She has a pause. There is the space where... We can't really tell if she's in a bad spell and this is it, or she truly feels the only way that she can have worth is tied specifically to the love and adoration of all the people that have surrounded her for years.
But you did mention in the aspect of that she's hesitant about it up until she sees the ad for her job that she once had, which was then fueled to be put in there by Harvey, which... Then goes back to my question, is it the catalyst of, you know, that situation, or is it just overall like a disdain for her own personal self?
I think it's a disdain for her own personal self, because like there is this, like even in that 1 second, there's like this moment of not moving on and letting go and going past it. I feel like that's probably...
Hello,
the tip off.
Hello.
I think you're right, because even as we, now that I think about it, even as we talk about like the third act and she's horribly, you know, horrifically disfigured due to the negligence of Sue, and she does opt for termination. Spoiler alert. She's opted for termination of the program. Even as she is midway through, she stops because she says to her, you know, we still have things to do. We still like the need.
But that note tipped her off first. Like that was, she saw that note of like, they're going to love you, break a leg. And that's the thing where she's like, oh yeah, you have all this stuff to do.
Yeah.
Like,
because she could then even, and see, that's the thing, that the balance in coming into the use of the substance without having balance to begin with, all you're doing is feeding an addiction. You're not dealing with the problem. You're not addressing the problem. You're essentially putting a Band-Aid over it until you have third act, final, you know, breaking point. And everything that you lose in not being willing to accept where you are and to continue to move on through it. And that is like, really, when we come down to the brass tacks of it and we talk about balance, it starts with loving yourself regardless of without the outside influences. It's how you feel about yourself. Because if she had been healthy and she had taken the substance, she would have seen every success that Sue had as part of her success.
Yeah, true. But can we actually say that in the society that this universe has built, that it's one that encourages such things? Because I don't feel like this universe is a normal universe. I feel
this
like
this universe is our universe. I think that's part.
No, it's definitely not.
I mean, that third act, it could have been.
No, it wasn't. But the fact is like, it made you happy.
Which part? Like, the explosion or the part?
Apparently the part about cutting people's arms off or boobs falling out of holes, or, you know. So, apparently Aim's really excited about those ones. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So you finally get to the explosion. It's no longer an implosion. It's an explosion of all things. And at that point, while we're standing on a stage, everybody...
Well, yep. Even before that, like you're... So again, and then this is why, like, I asked, because if the taking of the substance at that point is recognizing the problem, I guess is what you were saying, Spencer?
Oh, well, no, I was just like, it gives you the opportunity to basically confront yourself.
So then, spoiler alert, she ends up, Sue ends up taking it for herself.
Yeah.
And she reuses it.
Yeah. And then we get this horrifically disfigured
monstro
second person thing. What are we equating that to?
Well, I mean, first off, I equate it to not reading instructions. It says very clearly single use, yeah. Discard after
this person
use.
Has never shopped at IKEA. We know. But I mean, because I think about it, and again, this movie is one of those types where you could definitely dive down deep into a rabbit hole trying to understand a lot of the aspects of it.
Well, actually, I just figured it out. I'm sorry.
Oh, by all means, go on in.
Okay, because I feel like when Elizabeth first started, like, you know, and Sue showed up, like, you could see the problem of her hating herself.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sue kills Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. And then you see that she is now a monster, and she confronts a monster, basically, after that part.
So technically, taking the substance still equated to the same outcome, just the inner part that was going to come out was a monster.
Well, it's a monster because that's kind of what she turned into at that point. Because, like, she killed herself. Like, that was so crazy. She needs her to live. Mm-hmm. Like, she needs to extract, like, stuff. Why would you, like, damage yourself in such a self-sabotaging way? Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Because maybe you've never confronted and moved on.
Yeah. She slowly just kept getting worse until she became a monster.
There you go. And then let's... I don't want to give too much away, but ultimately that monster ends up going to... the New Year's performance, and we get complete chaos, which Amy seems to be absolutely giddy over the moon about.
It made me sad, but it was so ridiculous. It's kind of like, this is just nuts.
Yes.
We get to the fact of it that now Monstro Eliza Sue is the final. Like
the final form,
and you see that even in that space of desperation, somehow she's still cognitive enough to be like, I have to put on my dress, I have to put on my makeup, and even like she tries to curl her hair and she's putting all the things in and she's going, I'm still beautiful, they're gonna love me. Like, it's this desperation that even at this point where everything has gone wrong, everything is bad, you know, you do not fit the quote unquote societal standard that they're expecting of you, still attempting to try to show up, cutting off the giant Elizabeth Sparkle face and then gluing it to your face with the eye holes and extra lipstick. I was like, how desperate, like the literal desperation. And then nobody seems to notice that you're not you until you get on the stage and you go to talk and you're surrounded by topless showgirls because, you know, that's the only way a showgirl can show up.
Remember, don't forget who's in charge there. And so that's what they're wanting.
Yeah.
And for their end of the year celebration.
And even when Monstro Eliza Sue gets there to the stage, because now she's, you know, Sue for New Year's.
No, technically she's Elizabeth because she has Elizabeth's face.
Her name is Monstro Eliza.
I know, but Sue. I'm saying the face that she has on
her back. But yeah, no, when she's wearing on her face.
She literally super glues the cutout of the painting that was in the living room on her face of Elizabeth.
But the other thing that you think of is like, isn't it Dennis Quaid's character that's like, pretty girl, smile? Like that mm-hmm. whole concept. It's this desperation to not only be seen as beautiful, but to get back to where you were, where maybe at that point, if you had just recognize that your value and your worth was in yourself versus the accolades you can get from outside, that it would be okay. And then when it falls off and everybody loses their like everything, mm-hmm. and literally it turns into a B movie.
It turns into a Cronenberg movie, ultimately. Like, it turns into like a trauma movie at this point. It's like the Toxic Crusader walks into town.
There was a fun fact that the director actually was holding the hose that was hosing down everybody in the theater, which I was like, okay, that's kind of hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
It's, again, it made me sad because it's just like, I just want them to love me. I just want them to love me. They loved me once when I looked like this. And there's nothing there, and there's yep. no option. And it's just like, it's so sad.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It yeah. almost makes you like wonder, what was it that they were, I guess, seeing when they let her in the door and then they let her walk on stage?
Well, walk down the hallway.
Walk down the hallway. Yeah.
Meet with her.
Walked right past all those women, walked right up to the microphone with those women standing behind her. Seeing how she looked and the crowd seeing how her horribly disfigured self looked and not saying anything until the mask fell off. Like, I'm wondering what they were quote unquote looking.
Well, and if you think about it this way, everybody loves to watch a train wreck. You talked about it at the beginning, but especially when it comes to females in the entertainment industry, look at Britney Spears. Everybody loved watching her until there was an implosion that they all got to witness for free. And it is literally almost like in that moment when the mask has fallen off, their gaze, their view, like being watched, made that not only more possible, but it was almost like the lie that she fed herself to like explain why she was being so terrible to Elizabeth. Like why she just kept like sucking down the super special stabilizer sauce. Like it was the outside just lying to herself and justifying that the outside was the reason that this was okay.
I don't know.
I took a much more basic approach.
Okay.
I thought one, the women on stage, they're being paid and they saw her and they're like, that is not my problem. And I hate Harvey. And I'm just going to stand here and smile because that's what he told me to do.
And good point.
Paid,
yeah. And the other 100 people that were in the stands looking at her.
And the one
honest confusion, because I think I also would have been like, what the heck is going on here? And I'd be like, I would actually be like, what? And then like probably the thing would be drop and I'd be like, oh, I should have left already.
I mean, if you have somebody who sounds like that, I would immediately have said, like, I think she's choking. Someone get her CPR, whatever. Like, because it sounded like she was choking.
But but that really comes to the question of, in society, would you have leaned over to your neighbor and said, I think she's choking? Or would you stood up, if you were in that audience, stood up and said, I think she's choking. Somebody help her.
I would have stood up. I mean, that's kind of... I
would have been you, like...
She's making it through, so like she walked out here. So if she dies, that's on her at this point.
Wow,
she came out on stage while choking.
Yeah,
the looking show for must help. Go on.
No, you'd be like, "Help me!" Like, don't just ignore choking. It.
But also,
don't
what? You're so those, mean.
Those showgirls too. Like, what happened to women taking care of women? Like,
they're legit. Showgirls. Have you not seen the movie Showgirls?
They're gonna get paid either way.
Have you not seen the movie Showgirls? It's exactly what you would expect. They don't care. They're gonna get paid. They don't really care about what other people are going through.
Yeah, but I still, if she started choking, I would have been like,
they would have stood and smiled and watched her go down, watched her hit the floor.
That just makes me more sad.
And waved a boob.
They would not have done that.
They wouldn't have waved a boob.
The one that fell on the one that fell on the floor.
Remember what was it? What was
the, I'm just saying,
the Simpsons like episode? Clockwise.
Like a nunchuck just swinging it around.
With the tassels.
That was such a deep callback. It took me
and
a second.
You got it, though.
Yes. Oh, my God.
That's
you can't just wave a single one. They both have to go in a pair. Ha, 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 ha.
I don't have experience with that. So if you can knock yourself out.
I'm not going to knock myself out with a boob.
I did.
So anyway.
I meant with the situation. So I don't want to give it away, but what are your thoughts kind of on how it ends?
Oh, sad.
I mean, that's one way to put it. Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, I feel like the nature of kind of how this movie ends really, you know what? It's funny. What's funny about it is it reminds me about how The Wrestler ends.
Gosh, it is like that.
It just like in that like blaze of not so much even blaze of glory, but just in a moment of just
gasp.
Yeah, like a final recognition of where you were at once upon a time, and then in a minute, screen goes to black. Like that's kind of how I felt like this one ended. And even though it was more on like a silly kind of way of like, you know, the way everything kind of falls out towards the tail end, the sentiment hits just as hard as the ending of The Wrestler.
Yeah.
Like that weight of, you know, what's going to happen, and you see this person in a sense of like almost delusion, you know, and euphoria, you know, hoping to relive one last minute or one last second of that glory days, you know, feeling, and then nothing. Like it's very heartbreaking. But to be honest, like the fact is that, you know, the fact is that Demi Moore did that last scene, you know, in prosthetic, and I gotta give her, again, I gotta give her props with her face.
I mean, yeah,
that was actually a practical effect at the very end, not the movement of it, okay, but the very end.
Thank you.
The very end.
I was just like,
no, that's actually her face, like
so. Well, I was assumed so, because I was like, that's too good.
Yeah, that was technically
that. Well,
so full disclosure, that was the image I had seen of the prosthetic, the piece. And I'm like, what the heck is that? Like, I need to understand this better.
Well, that's the craziest thing to see.
Yeah,
all of them to see too.
Yeah, and of course that explained nothing about the movie, so I'm like, what? So it's, you know, but yeah, I honestly, overall, like, I feel like this movie really kind of took the Hollywood story, especially for women in the industry, women worldwide, since Amy wants to put it as such, like women around the world. Mm-hmm. It kind of puts a spotlight again on the fact that not much has changed, even after the fact of the Me Too movement, even after the fact of recognition of, you know, wrongdoings done by people of power around the world, even after the fact of people, you know, getting, you know, called on and doxxed and whistleblowed and everything else in between. We had what, over 7-8 years straight from like Me Too movement all the way up until now of people, you know, putting people on blast and whatnot. And still the same people who drive fear and you know, and anger amongst these types of professionals, most of them are still in power. Most of them still hold a place of power. Most of them still, you know, are pulling strings left and right. They're just not as vocal about it. Mm. I mean, for God's sakes, it drives me nuts for the fact that we allowed, like we were accepting of that kind of mentality in a Disney movie, no less. When you look at Toy Story 2 and the scene with Stinky Pete, and the two Barbie dolls. And we thought that was funny.
Yeah, that's the blooper end credit thing.
That was removed by Disney. If you look for it on Disney Plus, it is no longer there. But it's like the fact that we were okay to put that in a cartoon movie and accept that as commonplace, as regular, hey, this is silly. Yeah, yes, what? Blah, blah, blah. Oh, you want a job in the industry? Well, you know, you should come and meet me. You know, we can talk about it back in my office, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, we were okay with that. And I think that only speaks more towards of like the desensitization of where our heads were at that time and the accepting of just, this is the way the world is. You know, as the poem goes, you know, this is the way the world ends, not with a boom, but with a whimper. And it's like, we look at this and it's like, it's funny for us, but there were hundreds, if not thousands of women who were put through, as Amy put, so accurately put, were put through the meat grinder to make a name for themselves, even at a sense of just trying to make a buck in that industry, and had to go through all those same things, and we look at it in a cartoon movie and say, this is acceptable. You know, that it just I hate on myself because of the fact that, you know, I love the Toy Story franchise. And I thought it was, at the time, I was like, I was none the wiser because I didn't do research. I didn't look into it. I didn't whatever. And I looked at it. I thought it was funny, too. And it's like, now I'm like, I would never, ever want to show that to a kid nowadays and have them expect them to think this is a funny bit that they should accept as commonplace. Mm. And the fact that it took me this time to actually be educated and made aware of it only just reminds me more of that as an adult, I could have spent more time investing into that part. As much as I love movies, this is the part of myself that I feel like I'm so inadequate in, that I just wasn't more readily educated about the parts that really needed me to be educated in as a male, you know? And much like with this movie, like I feel like the cycle is still there. Like this movie is just recognizing that the cycle of how the world just grinds women up and takes them for what they can do as part of their ownership and not part of the woman's ownership. Like, oh, I'm going to take your ability to dance. I'm going to take your ability to act. I'm going to give you a little bit of coin for it, but you're ultimately belonging to me. Or I'm going to take your ability to do this, or I'm going to take your, you know, this is the net. And we're going to call it this. We're going to thin veil-y call it that. We're going to, you know, do it as that. We're going to call it an internship. No, I just, I had to put brevity in there. Just the fact that
you hired another intern and I am still an intern.
we technically inherited. We didn't. She started as a junior from last year and she just inherited into, it's like being grandfathered in or grandmothered in.
You're not winning.
I know, but you're looking at me like I'm supposed to come up with a reasonable answer for this.
Yeah, I am. I don't have to look at Spencer.
I didn't say anything.
Exactly.
Like a wise man.
Anyways, the fact remains that this movie just echoes the societal position that we're at currently in this day and age, that as much as we made strides during that time, the struggle never stops. The fight never stops. The push for recognizing that, you know, it's sad to say, but it still needs to be said that women are not objects, that women deserve to be treated beyond equals, because there are amazing women out there who do.
I'm sorry. I make life. I incubate life. So shouldn't I be a god?
I mean, technically, to a certain extent, but Spencer's confused face.
No, it's mostly it's like, what's that quote from something? That sounds super familiar.
Yeah, it's Marvelous Miss Maisel. They wrote it.
But I didn't see that.
No, but there is.
It might have been in a commercial or something.
But there is literally a quote where she says, because I can make life, am I not God?
Yeah.
And then there is somebody else who she didn't think was listening to her said, you were God. And she's like, oh, you actually were listening to me. He's like, yeah, I've always listened to you. And it's like, it has an entirely different thing. But in relation to that, there is no shortage of women across the world, regardless of industry, but especially in society and hyper specifically in the entertainment business, who will continue to bend themselves to fit just one more space to fit in the box that somebody else, that a man in power is looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And it will never be enough.
No.
And the understanding for this movie is the unbridled, untethered, in your face reminder that this movie is about two things. One, that you need to love yourself because you will never be enough to anybody else. And two, that it specifically is trying to make you feel uncomfortable by weaponizing the male gaze.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, you like this, you like this, you like this, don't you like this? And I remember, who was it? I was talking to somebody and they had said, they're like, yeah, I like this. And I feel bad that I like this. Like, I shouldn't like this, but I do. And it was all the dance sequences for the pump it up. It was the gyrating. It was the shots. It was like, it was built in, and this director never took her literal, took her eyes off the prize of reminding you that this isn't okay. This isn't acceptable. And I think that's also where there's some of the division in like people that like it and people that don't. Because it's like, well, I want to like what I want to like, and you shouldn't hit me over the head so hard with the message. And it's like, well, I'm sorry. If I thinly veil this message, you're not going to pay attention to me, or you're going to be like, no, that's not what I meant. I'm sorry. Like, it's like, no, you're going to get it. It's going to be in your face. It's going to be gross, and you're going to have other questions, and you're still going to have to deal with it. So it's very like apropos, courageous also for her second directorial debut.
So wrapping this thing up, let's go ahead and go around the table, talk about whether the film passes or fails and how many monocles. Let's start with Spencer.
Okay, this movie passes for me. It really does have a story, and it has, you know, just deep context all around. Man, where to even go? Like, the actors are phenomenal. The story's really great. And, you know, the body horror element really made me happy, to be perfectly honest. Like, because, like, there's just parts of the movie where I'm just like, ah, this is going so poorly, and it's amazing. Like, it was really just a fantastic watch. I had a lot of fun. And, like, it was even one where, like, people were coming into the room and just, like, being, like, perplexed by what in the world is happening here. But really fun. Highly recommend it. I'm going to give it 5 out of 5. I really enjoyed myself.
Ames?
So this film does pass. If you haven't heard us gushing and talking about deep complex issues or just generalized issues this entire episode, I don't think you've been paying attention. We might want to check on that. but really, with such a small cast, this director and this team make something that speaks volumes, and it never turns itself down to accommodate anybody else. I do not traditionally like horror films in any way, shape, or form. And this hit me in such a space where I simultaneously loved and hated myself for recognizing myself as a growing lady. I am getting older. I'm fine with that. But it's
you're getting more seasoned. You're right.
Yeah, we can code it whatever which way you want, but I have literal white hair and I'm not out of my 30s. So either way you shake that stick, it was just a call and reminder to me that loving myself is the balance. And that it's okay to be happy and accepting of that and not chase after what was. Again, amazing, amazing body horror. Like, so many things that were not comfortable for me. And I'm proud of myself for stepping out of that. So I guess that's going into my vote too. But really, this is so unexpected. And for films that we're seeing recently coming out of female directors and female writers, this is another one that I can honestly say I would be okay to watch again. And that says a lot, because
Spencer owns it, so we can always rewatch it.
Yes, right.
Like, yeah, there's some moments in this. But yeah, I'm actually going to echo Spencer and give it a 5 out of 5, because that's it's super rare for me, but it's well worth the praise.
I have to also agree. I feel like this movie definitely, as far as the story element goes, it is definitely a new spin on an old trope, but gives it new life. And I feel like that's something that we don't get very often, as far as like when you rehash certain stories, we usually get the same retelling just in different vehicles. This is a whole new way to tell the story that we have come to know and love, but in a vehicle that I don't think a lot of people saw coming. So it passes for me, and as far as monocles are concerned, this movie really does set the bar when it comes to creating that unique balance of body horror and socioeconomic like messaging, and even just the social commentary altogether on the state of where we are as far as gender equality. And to be frank, I feel like this movie needed to come out at just the right time. It did, especially with everything on the horizon. Well, that's currently happening and still on the horizon with, you know, our new administration and everything coming into play, like recognizing what that looks like. If there needed to be a absolute black and white, you know, telling of what it looks like when men who think they know everything try to rule the world, and what it does to the mental psyche and the emotional stability of people all around the world, especially women, when they are they are viewed as the lesser species by these types of individuals. Like, this absolutely hits it on the head. And I couldn't agree more as far as recognizing that, you know, this was a masterpiece, plain and simple. And yeah, so I'm going to give this also 5 monocles because, to be frank, I agree with Amy. I could watch this movie again and it still probably would hit me just as hard the second time, third time, fifth time, 100th time. This is a story that needs to be told and it needs to be recognized and people need to understand the messaging behind it immediately. So, but that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Filmlosophers. Let us know your thoughts. Did you enjoy the movie? Did you watch The Substance? If you did, what were your takeaways? I'd love to hear your thoughts in our tile section on our social media pages, whether if it's facebook.com/filmlosophers or at Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at Filmlosophy101. You can also catch us at Blue Sky at Filmlosophers Podcast. There we post all of our great stuff, including Spencer's Big Score and Amy's Jane on Scene. I swear I can talk. Amy's Jane on Scene, which can be found where?
Well, the only place it's ever lived, which is at Jane on Scene on Instagram and Instagram only. And if you're literally going, Amy, it hasn't been updated in ages.
Ages.
Please feel free to listen to some of our older episodes where you find delights like when I, you know, did a Jane on Scene for Cliffhanger because
Spencer,
that happened.
Did we ever get that Steel Magnolias?
I don't believe so.
Yeah, I was just going to...
But if ever you're wondering also what else I'm seeing / unseeing, we've got the intern files for your extra credit delights. And that is totally not posted on Instagram on Jane on Scene, but it's on our Filmlosophers.
It's on our main page. And what was the last one we did?
Oh my gosh, Flubbonomics. It was the intern files of Flubbonomics with Love Hurts.
That's wonderful. We also got, you can also listen to us over at our website at Filmlosophers Podcast. There you can check out all of our great episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thrills, and chills. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosopherspodcast.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audioboom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, Amazon Music. Tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmlosophers. Give us a follow or subscribe. Listen in. Drop your comments there as well. Let us know what you thought about this episode, other episodes, and we'd love to check out your messages and even talk about them here on the show. So... And if you think we did a great job, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
Yes, please.
This was a great movie. And of course, we mentioned before, it's absolutely awards worthy. And we think you should check it out too. So if you get a chance, check it out either on streaming or rent it or however you want to see it. But it's a great film. You should check it out. So again, this is us from the Filmlosophers. And we're glad that you were able to join us tonight. So from all of us here, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I'm Amy.
Oh, okay. Mm. Class dismissed. Yes.
Literally says, yeah, grapefruit concentrate.
So, I mean, if you'd like to cause me a whole bunch of pain, by all means, just...
Okay, I don't know the medicine and its reactions. Okay. Or is that just a you thing?
No, that's the reactions.
The medicine, okay. The medicine's the reaction.
See? And now I know something.